It's 4 minutes after 8 o'clock. Welcome to the Morning Magazine for Tuesday, March 22nd of 2022. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. Thank you for joining us here on listener-supported community radio. Coming up on today's program, a gunman shot and killed 10 people at King Super Supermarket in South Boulder 1 year ago today. We remember the victims and hear from Colorado State Representative Judy Amable about the state and community's response to the tragedy. After that, 50 years after the Clean Water Act, rivers and lakes are still polluted. We'll hear that story and more from H2O Radio. At the bottom of the hour, we'll go to the BBC News headlines. Then it's Rising Tide. And then at 9 o'clock, it's The Wit and Wisdom of Alan Watts, the British philosopher, writer, and speaker known for interpreting Eastern religious ideas for a Western audience. Then at 9:30, it's The Morning Sound Alternative, bringing you 2.5 hours of eclectic music until noon. All of that is still coming up, but first, these local and regional headlines with KGNU's Stacey Johnson.
Today marks the one-year anniversary of the mass shooting that killed 10 people at the Boulder King Supers Table Mesa location. King Supers is closing the newly opened Table Mesa store today in honor of those killed and those affected by the tragedy. In addition, the supermarket chain will have a moment of silence today at all its stores beginning at 2:30 this afternoon. Other remembrances and events include a line of duty death commemoration beginning at 2 p.m. in honor of slain officer Eric Talley. The city of Boulder will also hold a citywide moment of silence starting at 2:30 p.m. The day will conclude with a community-wide day of remembrance with Governor Jared Polis, Congressional Representative Joe Neguse, and other community leaders gathering at the Glen Huntington Bandshell starting at 4:30. For anyone affected by the tragedy and or dealing with grief and loss, the Boulder Strong Resource Center at 2935 Baseline Road is open to provide help. An alliance of environmental groups files a petition to reverse a Polis administration decision to delay the Advanced Clean Trucks rule. KGNU's Steve Miller has more.
The petition was sent to the Colorado's Air Quality Control Commission, AQCC, requesting the adoption of the Advanced Clean Trucks rule by the end of this year. Colorado Newsline reports that last month, Governor Jared Polis's administration had pushed back the climate rulemaking until at least 2023. Officials with the Polis administration pushed back the Advanced Clean Trucks rule, originally scheduled for mid-2022, using a variety of explanations, including the ongoing global supply chain issues that could impact the availability of electric vehicle batteries and impede trucking companies' ability to participate in the rulemaking process. The Advanced Clean Trucks rule is modeled on requirements passed by California and at least 5 other states that is aimed at reducing greenhouse gas emissions by requiring medium and heavy-duty vehicle manufacturers to sell an increasing percentage of zero-emission models. This is the same approach that Colorado has taken with passenger cars through the zero-emission vehicle mandates. The environmental groups and other petitioner signers, like Boulder County and the City and County of Denver, request that the AQCC adopt the Advanced Clean Trucks rule no later than the end of 2022, putting its requirements back on track to take effect in 2025. I'm Steve Miller for KGNU.
Journalists at the Colorado News Collaborative and the Colorado Springs Gazette have revealed that 3 state agencies have kept from the public an investigation showing the Grand Junction-based Mine Springs Health and its psychiatric hospital, West Springs, has put many of its patients at severe risk and harm. The Regional Mental Health Center treats patients from 10 Western Slope counties. The report reveals quality of care concerns, which investigators rated as severe life and threatening impact for close to half of the 58 outpatients they sampled. Among the investigation's findings, Mine Springs gave dozens of outpatient clients high doses of the tranquilizer benzodiazepine, putting the patients at severe risk of harm and death. According to the report, the 3 state agencies, the Department of Health Care Policy and Financing, the Department of Human Services, and the Department of Public Health and Environment, withheld the investigation from the public for over 9 months and only released findings after the reporters exposed the failings of Mine Springs and pursued information under the Colorado's Open Records Act. The reporters said the agencies have not answered questions as to why they did not alert the public to prescribing errors by Mine Springs. Mine Springs executives have also not provided comment. Noise complaints from air traffic increase at Rocky Mountain Metropolitan Airport. KGNU's Rashik Jahan has more.
The residents of Broomfield and the communities living near the Rocky Mountain Metropolitan Airport have reported an increase in noise due to flights to and from the airport. The Rocky Mountain Metropolitan Airport developed a group called the Community Noise Roundtable in order to work with residents and businesses using the airport to find ways to reduce the noise. The Broomfield Leader reports that the number of noise complaints filed by residents and the number of households submitting complaints have increased since 2014. Over the last year, the number of flights at the airport has also increased. In 2020, the Homeowners Association for the residents of the Rock Creek Subdivision in Superior filed a lawsuit against the Jefferson County Airport. In order to further examine the noise issues, identify alternate flight paths, and propose other ways to reduce the air traffic noise, the Community Noise Roundtable is working to find a consulting firm with a focus on transportation, planning, and aviation. For KGNU, I'm Rashik Jahan.
Officials from Cherry Creek Schools canceled the annual Sentinel A-Town All-Star Boys and Girls Basketball Games that were scheduled for last night at Aurora's Overland High School. School officials say, after consulting with law enforcement, they decided to cancel the event on Sunday. A district spokesperson told the Aurora Sentinel yesterday that Cherry Creek Schools received an alert to a potential threat on social media, specifically targeting the All-Stars game or the venue. Officials also told the Aurora Sentinel that the spate of gang-related violence along the Front Range and social media threats have elevated the potential risk of youth violence in the region. The Aurora Sentinel editor Dave Perry said students and coaches from across the region will assess the possibility of rescheduling the event, which features at least one player from each of Aurora's 11 high schools. Starting tonight at 9 p.m. and until 5 a.m. tomorrow morning, the Colorado Department of Transportation will close I-25 and U.S. Highway 34 near Loveland in order for crews to pour concrete on the new deck portion of U.S. Highway 34 bridge. Crews will reroute nighttime traffic around the affected areas. More information is available at the project hotline of 720-593-1996. U.S. Highway 287 between Broomfield and Lafayette is also seeing a closure this week as crews deal with repairs to the railroad tracks from the Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway. Closure of the highway segment between Marymount Boulevard and Dillon Road began yesterday, and officials expect the closure to last through Saturday, March 26. For today's weather, the sky will have increased clouds with highs in the mid-40s. There is a 30% chance of snow showers after 3 p.m. Winds could gust as high as 30 to 38 miles per hour. Tonight's lows will be in the upper 20s. Tomorrow's forecast includes sunny skies with highs in the 50s. The current temperature in Boulder is 30 degrees. For KGNU, I'm Stacy Johnson.
You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. 1 year ago today, a gunman shot and killed 10 people at a neighborhood supermarket in South Boulder. The names of those people are Denny Strong, 20 years old, Naveen Stanishik, 23 years old, Ricky Olds, 25, Tralona Bartkoviak, 49 years old, Susan Fountain, 59 years old, Terry Liker, 51 years old, Officer Eric Talley, 51 years old, Kevin Mahoney, 61 years old, Lynn Murray, 62 years old, and Jody Waters, age 65. All of these people lost their lives. It was one of the deadliest mass shootings in Colorado state history. KGNU's Rosanna Longo-Better reported on the event that day and interviewed State Representative Judy Amable at the scene of the crime last year.
Hey, I'm Judy Amabile, and I'm the state representative to House District 13, which is where this King Supers is. And I'm here, I stopped here because I was just compelled to come. And
little did I know that.
The scene is just incredible. I've never seen so many police cars in one place in Boulder. And, you know, I've heard that several people have lost their lives. And I am just overcome with this coming home to Boulder, where it was inevitable that this was going to happen here eventually, because it's happening all over our country. And we really have to address this epidemic of gun violence. And we also have to, I don't know anything about the potential perpetrator of the crime, but I do know that we really also have to help people who are suffering with mental illness. And we haven't been doing a good job of that, and we need to do better. And so, you know, we're working on things at the State House this year on gun control measures and common sense gun safety measures, but that's not enough. There's so much more that we have to do, because it's part of our culture, and that we have to change that. And I'm not sure how you do that, but I think you have to start brick by brick. And I'm really devoted to working on that. I've talked to two people now who don't know if their loved one is okay. And I talked to the victim's advocate, and they don't know where people should go to find out if their person has been hurt. I talked to a man whose wife went shopping an hour ago, and he doesn't know if she's in there or where she is or what happened. And so it's kind of surreal and a little bit calm, but also chaotic, because nobody knows what's happening.
Any last thoughts? It's a cold afternoon. It's packed, but at the same time, like you're saying, it's calm and it's frozen and it feels cold, and we are all impacted.
Yeah, I think we're all going to be in shock over this for some time to come. And we've got to get our community to rally around and support each other and make sure the victims' families feel supported, and the people who were in the store who are traumatized by what happened today. And we really have to just circle the wagons and make people feel loved.
Judy Amabile, you have made mental health advocacy a cornerstone of your work as a legislator. Listening back to this recording,
made me cry.
How do you feel listening back to it?
Oh, well, I mean, it's really sad, and it's hard to listen to that from the day, because it takes you back to how you felt. And so much despair and fear, and also some deep resignation that our country is in a very difficult place, and that we have to really work to make things better. Last session, after the shooting, we passed three bills that were specifically about the shooting at King Soopers. That felt like a significant achievement on top of the three bills, the three common sense gun bills that we had already run, but also insufficient to meet the moment. So this session, I have been working really hard on passing mental health legislation that might help people get care when they're in a crisis or when they're really not doing well. I have, I don't know how many bills this session, five or six, that are about that. We have to do both. We have to help people to feel safe and to feel like there's care available and that there's a pathway for them to get care or for their family member to get care. And we also have to make sure that we have good, smart gun laws that limit the amount of guns that we have out on our street and that ensure that people who shouldn't have guns can't get them.
Has there been any change or any movement in preventing such tragedies? Are we better prepared now?
So the policies that we enacted last session haven't all taken hold And I don't really know how we're going to measure whether we've been successful or not, because it is kind of hard to measure. One of the bills that I ran said that if you have been found guilty of a violent misdemeanor, you are not allowed to buy a gun for 5 years. And the King Super shooter had committed one of those violent misdemeanors that would now have precluded him from buying a gun. So I don't know whether how often that might be the case, but that was the case with him. Then we also passed a law that said local governments can enact their own gun legislation. And I know that the city and county in Boulder are working on that. They're working on what it is they want to do and whether they want to have that happen countywide or city by city. So they haven't done it yet, but I know that that's something that people are really dedicated to figuring out. And that means they could have a law that says you have to be 25 to buy a gun. You have to wait 3 days before you can take your gun home. A bunch of things that were not doable at the state level can happen at the local level, and I'd love to see them start doing that. And then the third bill that we passed that was in direct response to this shooting event was standing up and staffing the Office of Gun Violence Prevention. And that hasn't gotten, I mean, it's we're working on it. But to me, that might be the best thing that we did last year in terms of gun violence prevention, because we do need to understand what are the precursors to gun violence. What does the data show us? What are the best laws that we could put into place that would have an effect on these mass shooting events, but also on everyday gun violence, on suicide with a gun, on domestic violence? All of these things are the subject that of the Office of Gun Violence Prevention, and I'm really looking forward to seeing what they come up with.
What are we doing to make sure that people with mental issues do not have access to guns and that they get diagnosed and treated?
The legislature this past interim time before this session started, we allocated $450 million for mental health care. And we set up this behavioral health transformational task force, which I was very lucky to be a member of. And that task force is now completed its work, made recommendations, and those recommendations are now turning into legislation and appropriations of these monies that came from the ARPA funds from the federal government that are going to go towards mental health care. So one of those bills, which I'm going to be the prime sponsor of, creates beds, treatment beds, residential care facilities. And it's 125 beds in, you know, 10 or 15 facilities, small facilities spread around the state, so that somebody whose family sees my person isn't doing well, and maybe they get them to the ER and they place them on a three-day hold. Well, right now, at the end of the three-day hold or the 1 or 2 days that they keep you, they have nothing for you. So you're just released, and there is no follow-up. There is no ongoing care. But this would allow the opportunity to go from one of those holds into a facility where you would get longer-term care and treatment and have the opportunity to get stabilized on a treatment plan. Then other bills will create permanent supportive housing for people who need that, so that they have wraparound services. They have a place to live. They have somebody who helps them with their medication, maybe somebody who helps them with employment issues, that kind of thing. And then there's bills that put money into the mental health workforce so that we have more people on the ground doing this work, because we have a huge shortage of employees. And then there's a bill that's going to coordinate care, so put money into care coordination. So again, you as a person experiencing a mental health crisis or a mental health problem can call and get somebody who can help you to find the right care. And then we have another bill that's being run that is about all of these things for children, youth, and families, because that is sort of a special group that requires special interventions. And I think if we can get early intervention, we will stop a lot of people from progressing down to more and more serious mental illness. And then there's a bill that is going to coordinate care between physical and mental health so that you can go to one place and have all of your needs met, and somebody will help to understand what are the physical implications of your mental health and what are the mental health implications from your physical health.
Sounds like a lot of legislation that has been put forward to prevent another tragedy. Is there something else that you would like others to know?
The other thing that's happening is that we're standing up this Behavioral Health Administration, which is going to have the director of that Behavioral Health Administration is going to be a cabinet level appointee in the governor's office. That office will be responsible for all of the behavioral health care in the state, and will coordinate between all the other agencies that have some nexus to mental and behavioral health. And I think that has the potential to be really a very good change for the state.
I have been speaking with Judy Amabile, representative of District 13, who has made health advocacy a cornerstone of her work as a legislator today on the day of the sad anniversary of the mass shooting here in Boulder.
Thank you for the opportunity, and I'm so happy that we're spending the day today honoring the victims of this horrible tragedy.
Thank you so much again, Judy.
Thanks, Rosanna.
For KGNU, I am Rosanna Longobetter.
Time now for This Week in Water with H2O Radio's Jamie Sudler and Franny Halperin.
Rivers and lakes are still polluted 50 years after the Clean Water Act. That story and more on H2O Radio's weekly news report. I'm Jamie Sudler.
I'm Franny Halperin, and it's This Week in Water.
It's been half a century since the landmark Clean Water Act was signed into law with the purpose of making U.S. waters fishable and swimmable. But a new study finds that many waterways and lakes are still so contaminated that people can't safely play in them.
A new report from the Environmental Integrity Project, a nonprofit watchdog group made up of former EPA officials, shows that 700,000 miles of waterways and more than 50% of lake areas are impaired, meaning that people who recreate in them are at risk of getting sick from pollutants, including fecal pathogens. It also means additional treatment is needed for drinking water, and it could be hard for fish to survive because of low oxygen levels.
The study finds that although there were improvements made during the first 30 years after the Clean Water Act's passage, there has been a lack of enforcement by the Environmental Protection Agency, and the law itself needs to be updated.
The report says climate change is a major factor in some states like Oregon, where streams are impaired because they've become too warm. In Indiana, which has the most total miles of rivers and streams that are unusable for recreation, agricultural and industrial runoff have contributed to the problem.
Florida is first for total acres of lakes that are impaired for swimming and aquatic life. California heads the list of states for most miles of streams and rivers impaired as a source of drinking water.
Ukraine has been called the breadbasket of Europe, supplying much of the world's wheat and corn, as well as sunflower oil. But Russia's invasion is disrupting trade, and that's exacerbating a global hunger crisis already fueled by the pandemic, supply chain issues, and climate change.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres said the sword of Damocles hangs over the global economy, especially in the developing world, adding, "We must do everything possible to avert a hurricane of hunger and a meltdown of the global food system."
A spokesperson for the World Food Program said they're concerned concerned not only about food shortages for people in Ukraine, but also, in their words, about collateral hunger for those in the Middle East and Africa, places that rely heavily on imported grains. If the war prevents planting this spring, the consequences could be dire.
Also, Russia is a major wheat exporter and supplies much of the world's fertilizer, phosphorus, and potash. But the country has banned its sales, sending prices soaring for farmers who might not be able to afford inputs.
Climate change could make the entire situation worse if countries that try to take up the slack are impacted by severe weather, droughts, heat waves, or floods. Higher prices could lead to more clear-cutting for food production, which would release carbon into the atmosphere and further global warming.
And speaking of global warming, heat waves in the ocean have been increasing. They are triggered by various conditions, including human-caused climate change, which is making them more frequent and intense.
Marine heat waves can be devastating to ecosystems and cause mass coral bleaching and significant declines in kelp forests and seagrass meadows, and also trigger algal blooms, leading to mass sea life mortality.
40 years ago, heat waves had occurred in about 60% of the ocean, but as of 2020, that increased to 80%. They can be offset by periods of cold waves. However, a new study shows that those are occurring less frequently and less intensely than they did just 4 decades ago.
The study led by the University of Tasmania shows that over the last decade, marine cold spells happened about 10 days per year globally, down from 40 in 1985.
While cold spells can also be devastating to marine life, they can offset the impacts of the excess ocean heat.
And finally, California's coast redwood trees are amazing. They can grow to nearly 400 feet tall and live for hundreds of years thanks to natural resistance to insects and fire.
And new research is revealing even more secrets about the tree's longevity. Redwoods have 2 different types of leaves that allow them to thrive in both wet and dry areas of California.
Scientists from the University of California, Davis, discovered the trees have a peripheral leaf that converts sunlight into sugar through photosynthesis, and an axial leaf that does not photosynthesize, but instead spends its time absorbing water. Remarkably, the study found that a large redwood can suck up to 14 gallons in just the first hour its leaves get wet.
Even more fascinating is that the leaves shift their position on the tree depending on the climate. Along California's rainy north coast, the water-absorbing axial leaves are found on lower branches, while the photosynthesizing leaves were closer to the top to access the sun.
The pattern flips in the southern part of the state. The water-absorbing axial leaves were up high to make the most of rain and fog. The findings could help researchers monitor redwoods as the climate warms and offer clues as to how the trees will respond to drought and stress.
That's it for This Week in Water, which is sponsored by Bring Back the Blue, working to remove plastics from the ocean to support energy projects and the blue economy. Learn more at bringbacktheblue.blue.
And that's all the time we have for today's Morning Magazine. Thanks to Stacey Johnson, Rashid Jahan, Steve Miller, Rosanna Longo-Better, Franny Halperin, and Jamie Sudler for their contributions to today's program. I've been your host, Alexis Kenyon.